You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine, and this afternoon we're going to talk about the personalities of public radio, the voices we've come to rely on to keep us informed and to entertain us. A lot of us listen to public radio. I listen when I'm not at work. 27 million people listen to public radio in the United States, and it's those voices that keep pulling us in. Think of the hosts of Morning Edition. And All Things Considered, for example, Renee Montaigne, Steve Inskeep, Robert Siegel, Melissa Block, and Michelle Norris. Then there's Ira Glass and Bill Littlefield, Garrison Keillor, Tavis Smiley, and those two guys who warn us not to drive like my brother. Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the program is a journalist who has worked as a reporter, producer, and host for several public radio stations. Her name is Lisa Phillips. She is currently teaching journalism at the State University of New York at New Paltz. She is the author of the new book, Public Radio, Behind the Voices. And listeners, you can join our conversation this afternoon with a telephone call. Your questions and comments are invited. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're listening outside the Champaign-Urbana area, use our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Lisa Phillips' book, Public Radio, Behind the Voices, is published by CDS Books. Lisa, it's so good to talk with you. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Today.
My pleasure. When and how did you become hooked on public radio?
I think I got hooked on public radio during college. I went to Oberlin College, and WKSU out of Kent State University broadcasts into that area of Ohio. And I remember hearing they did something on the anniversary of Kent State. It was this audio montage. It was a lot of sound from that devastating point in our history. And I just thought, wow, what a thing to do in the world, to create this tremendous emotion and these tremendous pictures in one's mind through the radio airwaves. And at the time, I was at the student radio station and starting to experience probably what you know well, Celeste, that magic of being on the air and having people respond to what you do on the air. I was a jazz DJ and had listeners around campus and got that thrill of someone saying, oh, yeah, I was listening to you last night. So I think those two things combined made me think, wow, this is really a place to be for me and a profession that I respect very much.
Hmm. And now would you tell us the story about that train trip you took that set you on course to write this book?
Yeah, back in 1992, I was working my first full-time job in public radio, which was in the very glamorous location of Fort Dodge, Iowa, north central Iowa, and I'm from the Northeast, so this was a very unlikely place for me to be. And I was on a two-day train trip back home to New York City, and I'm from suburban Connecticut, so that was where I was heading eventually. And I found myself chatting with people around the train, you know, in the dining car and so forth, and once they found out what I did for a living, that I worked in public radio, they had so many questions for me. They wanted to know how it worked, and they especially wanted to know about the national voices at the time. Bob Edwards was the host of Morning Edition. They wanted to know about him. They wanted to know about Scott Simon, Terry Gross. And I told them what I could at the time, what I had heard around the industry. And I thought, there's something very intense and very special about this relationship that public radio listeners have with these voices. And I think I thought for the first time at that point back in 1992 there could be a book in this. And then I continued to feel that way throughout the years of my own career in public radio, and I was also in graduate school for writing, so I thought about it then. And then finally about 4 years ago I thought, okay, now is the time for me to be the person to start working on this book and to write this book.
Yeah. Now, is there something that we all have in common about how all of us, whether we're working in Fort Dodge or Urbana, Illinois, or we're working in Washington, D.C., or Los Angeles, or we're at NPR, is there something that holds us together? Are there commonalities in terms of what has brought us to this choice of how to make a living?
I would say there is. I guess maybe on one level, in the most obvious way, we are all committed to radio. Okay, so that's obvious, but there's something deeper going on there because we're committed to radio in an age where we can get information through many senses. We can get TV, which is visual and audio. We have the internet, which provides so much to us. But we insist on continuing to devote our lives to this medium that only works through the ears. And I think that is a very special kind of, forgive me for sounding a bit maudlin perhaps, but a special kind of person who devotes his or her life to that medium, because it says we're willing to be invisible. We're willing to use this one sense to communicate. And that is that's an unusual thing.
Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, all of us who love radio, we not only, those of us who make radio, we love to listen to radio. And I think the reason we have come to make radio, if you will, cook up radio, is that we love to listen to it. And I think we want to be part of that, you know, of we want to be on that end of it. You know, one of the things that you say early in your book is, you know, all of us are turning to radio as listeners for stories, for music, for community, for insight, for laughter, the kinds of things that brought families around the Philco in the days before television took center stage in the living room. You know, it's the stories, it's the community.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, that is what we want to take part in. We want to be a part of that magic.
Yeah. And the people that make the magic at NPR, you know, it's funny when we think about them, we know them just by first names.
Say Renee, we say Steve, yeah.
Cokie, yeah. Nina, Linda, you devote a chapter to those three very fine public radio journalists who have been with the network from its infancy. The chapter is titled The Fallopian Jungle. Tell us where that title comes from.
It's a rather evocative term, isn't it? Well, there is an unnamed, at least to me, staff member, male staff member at NPR, who called them the Fallopian Jungle. And the term is really interesting. It's easy to think of it as like, oh, how insulting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he dismissed these women by calling them the Fallopian Jungle. But I think actually for me, it gives a sense of the power that they had. You know, they were a jungle. They were formidable. They were three women who were aggressive, assertive, smart, enterprising reporters covering Capitol Hill, covering the Supreme Court, and they basically formed the journalistic core of National Public Radio in a time when NPR was very experimental, did a lot of sort of adventures in sound, and was still making its name as a serious journalistic enterprise, and I think they helped make that name and grab that place. So I think that there's a lot of envy and really submissiveness in that idea that this guy would throw out this term and try to put these women in their place. But actually, he's probably sitting there thinking, ah, if I had only been one of them, you mm-hmm. know, now many, many years later, three decades in the future, thinking back to that moment of coming up with that phrase.
Yeah. But, you know, as you point out, the news business is a competitive one, and newsrooms are very often very competitive spaces. But these three women, assertive and enterprising as they are, as they were back at the infancy of NPR, they took another approach. Tell us about the approach that they took to their work and one another.
Yeah, that's a really important thing to point out about them. First of all, physically, the three of them worked in a cubicle together in the 1970s when NPR budget was very tight. There wasn't much money to pay for the room to put people in their desks, and there wasn't much money to pay people. And they just took it all on. They typed nearly elbow to elbow, as they describe it. And they were very assertive about getting stories, but they also made it really a kind of way of cementing their friendship instead of a way of being competitive in a negative sense. They would divide things up. This was the way Linda Wertheimer put it to me. And they had no problem dividing things up and each going their own way with different stories. And they would compete, but how they compete would be that they'd compete to be the best in what they chose to do and how fast, how good, how detailed, how fresh their stories could be. And so they made it into a very healthy competition, and they became, over the years, extremely good friends. I mean, to the point where, you know, in one case, Nina Totenberg's husband, first husband, former Colorado Senator Floyd Haskell, he was injured in a fall and in the hospital, and Nina thought that he was going to die alone because she was out in Oklahoma City covering a story. She flew home and went into his hospital room to find Cokie Roberts sitting there, taking care of him, being by his side. And, you know, Nina knew then that he was not alone through that whole time because Cokie was right there. And I think that's a beautiful story about two very successful, prominent women spelling each other, not only cooperating in their professional lives, but cooperating in their personal lives and dropping everything to be there for each other.
Yeah. Man, imagine having, you know, advocates like those three women you while you're in a hospital bed, you know, fighting for your life. What a great thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of makes you jealous, doesn't it?
Yeah.
How many people have friends like that?
Yeah.
Not to mention people as successful and as prominent as they are.
And sharp.
And sharp, yes.
Yeah. When did All Things Considered first go on the air, and what do you think these three women, Linda Wertheimer, Cokie Roberts, and Nina Totenberg, contributed to the program's identity?
Well, All Things Considered was NPR's first program, and basically it was NPR for the first several years of National Public Radio. It went on the air 35 years ago, and in fact the anniversary broadcast was sometime in the past couple of weeks,
mm-hmm.
I can't remember the exact date,
mm-hmm.
Back in 1971. And then as far as their particular contribution to it, Linda Wertheimer was the first director of All Things Considered, which is a great place to play in history, and then went on to become a reporter for the show and then a host for the show for many, many years. And so she started with the program in 1971, part of the very first staff of the very first show. Nina was hired in 1975, and Cokie was hired in 1978, very much because Nina and Linda were rallying for her to be hired, because Cokie had made her name in television and in print journalism. They were like, hey, let's get her. She's great. And they made that happen. And I think basically they helped establish the program, as I mentioned before. It was at first kind of a quirky place where people would do experiments in sound and big, long audio documentaries and all kinds of wonderful stuff. They helped make its place journalistically, as they helped take the program into the mainstream of Washington journalism. And they would cover stories and do enterprising work. They would have scoops. They would be right there on Capitol Hill and in the Supreme Court, along with the rest of the Washington Press Corps, and they helped establish All Things Considered as a program that could cover the mainstream issues as well as the things that were somewhat offbeat.
Hmm. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine is journalist Lisa Phillips. She's the author of Public Radio, Behind the Voices. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments about public radio and the people who make public radio what it is. Join us with a telephone call, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. We have a listener waiting to talk with us in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I have a historical question, actually. It seems to me that I remember the name back from the early days of a woman by the name of Barbara Koppel. Was she ever with NPR, or am I thinking of that from somewhere else?
Is this the filmmaker?
Yes, I believe she also made a film about, as I recall, coal strike.
Coal strike. I've met Barbara. She also covered the Woodstock festivals. I don't know if she was part of NPR. I'm sorry about that.
But it
would make sense because she's a wonderful documentarian.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that was my question. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Other questions are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. One of the early hosts for All Things Considered, I believe, was Bob Edwards. Is that correct?
Yes, he was a host for All Things Considered.
Yeah.
soon after he joined the network. He did that until Morning Edition was created.
And he agreed to do that for 30 days.
Yeah, he said, okay, I'll get up that early in the morning for 30 days, and then 30 days passed, and the job was still open, and he was invited to take it, and he took it, because, who wouldn't? That's an amazing opportunity to, make a name for yourself, however difficult the hours might be. So he was with NPR from 1974 until 2004, when he was asked to leave Morning Edition.
Yeah. Well, today he's no longer at NPR. I think it's NPR's loss, but he is on satellite radio. What was the transition like for him?
Not easy and not pleasant, to be quite blunt about it. I do include Bob in the book because I think he's crucial to the history of public radio, and he does now just recently started to do a weekend version of his satellite radio show for public radio, and it's called Bob Edwards Weekend, and a number of stations are airing that. Basically, what happened with Bob is that he was asked to leave as the host of Morning Edition in 2004, as I mentioned, and he was offered a job as what's called a special correspondent, which is kind of, an open position where you get to do special projects and all kinds of things. And he was getting ready to take that, but I think what happened was he was very disturbed at the discussion of why he left. He felt he never got a real straight answer, and he felt that the answers given to the press or hinted to the press were things that, he told me. He said he really felt they were smears, that he was asked to go out in the field more often, and he didn't. He was asked to share his job, and he didn't. He basically calls all that stuff just lies. But he also shared with me that he felt a host should be in the studio hosting the show, as opposed to going out to the field. So I really don't know the extent of that discussion. And so he left to host a program called The Bob Edwards Show at XM Satellite Radio. And some of the fallout continued. Many, many thousands and thousands of listeners emailed NPR to express their feelings about his departure. I think a number of listeners were very attached to who he was and his voice and his presence. And in the media, discussion continued about, okay, well, why really did he leave? And then there was an issue where he invited some NPR personalities to be on his show, and then NPR invoked what's called a non-compete clause to tell them, no, actually, you can't go on this show because it competes with us. And I think that was a disappointment to him. So it was a very uncomfortable situation, I think, on both sides. And but I should say that Bob Edwards continues to visit member stations to express his support for public radio, to help public radio stations raise money. He still does a lot to affirm his commitment to the system as a whole.
Yeah. How do the senior journalists at NPR feel about changes that happen over time, about being dubbed senior correspondents?
Linda Wertheimer and I talked about this because she had something very similar happen to her when the change in the cast of All Things Considered happened. Robert Siegel stayed, but then Melissa Block and Michelle Norris took on the other host seats, and she and Noah left. Noah Adams wanted to leave, not leave the network, but they went on to become reporters. Noah Adams wanted the change. He asked for it. Linda Wertheimer said, look, I didn't ask for it. I didn't agree with it, but they made this decision, and I'm gonna stick with it. And so it was clear to me that this was a very disappointing turning point in her career, but she has gone on to do a lot of political reporting, a lot of other kinds of reporting, and to stay with the network as a political correspondent. So I don't, it was a little uncomfortable for her as well, but not nearly the level of controversy that the Bob Edwards changeover evoked.
Yeah. Well, in your profile of Robert Siegel, he told you, I feel so ambivalent about the state of broadcast journalism. I don't know what I would do if I weren't doing this. And now he's been a longtime host of All Things Considered, and he's been with the network for a very long time as well. So it's got to be, it gets into your makeup, your cellular makeup, I guess.
Yeah, and he still loves, after all this time, every day this idea that he can put on a show. I asked him, do you ever think about longer-term projects, like writing a book or something like that? And he is quite attached to that day-to-day activity of working in All Things Considered. I've had other hosts of other programs in the system tell me that the Bob Edwards saga made them worried about their position. Robert and I didn't discuss that in particular because we had our interview before this changeover, but other hosts that I spoke with afterward were like, hey, I'm in my 50s. I've been doing this for a long time. You know, is this going to happen to me? And we can't really say because this is not something that we get, you know, prior notice of. It just happens one day. So, and then there were other people who told me privately that they were very supportive of the Bob Edwards change, and they thought it was a very important one for National Public Radio to make.
Yeah, that's just unfortunate the way it happened, I think.
Right before his 25th anniversary.
Yeah.
Not exactly the celebration you would hope for after all that hard work and all those mornings of getting up at 1:30 and driving into work.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's Robert Siegel's background? What's he like?
Robert Siegel has a story that I think extends to the generation previous, extends to his parents. And what I mean by that is his parents were both either from Eastern Europe or descended from Eastern European immigrants, and he grew up in New York, and he felt that looking at his parents' life, they were very interested in obtaining proper speech. It was in those days known as elocution. His mother, who's the daughter of immigrants from Lithuania, attended Hunter College in the 1930s. And then in those days at Hunter College, and I know this too because my grandmother was there at that time, you come out of Hunter College with a very, very refined spoken English that's almost theatrical. It's a very lovely way of speaking. And then his father, also the child of immigrants from Eastern Europe, was in the public school system in New York City. He was a public school teacher and later an administrator. And in order to work his way up, his father had to take a speech test. And he went through this. He didn't pass it initially. He had to go through the speech test again, and he would practice talking into a tape recorder to make sure he was getting those syllables right and that he wasn't having too much of a New York accent or too much of an immigrant accent. And so this is how Robert grew up, and this makes all the sense in the world that he should go into radio and that he should have the very refined and lovely speech that he has, because this was shown to him to be so important in his childhood years. And then he went on to go on the air at Columbia University at their radio station there during the student protests of 1968, an incredibly exciting time then, and that's what led him into radio.
Mm. And we have him to thank for Weekend Edition Saturday with Scott Simon.
Yeah, he was part of the energy behind that. He was news director at the time, and he saw great talent in Scott. And he and Scott and Jay Kernis, who remains an executive at NPR, thought up that show and made it what it is today.
Yeah. Here we've got some wonderful voices. You know, you mentioned Robert Siegel's concerns about speech. Also, you know, Scott Simon has his own style, his own voice. Ira Glass, same thing. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting that Melissa Block, you say, she said, she told you, Block said figuring out what her own voice, her style is, has been tricky for her. She sounds so natural. She sounds just like Melissa Block.
It's interesting because, of course she does. She sounds natural. She sounds like Melissa. Mm-hmm. I don't think listeners think of her this way. But I think what this says is, it speaks to the way that even the people that we would never question what they did and we would, you know, really admire what they do, how they still have their struggles and their insecurities and their ways that they're working on who they are on the airwaves. And so Melissa was very open about that, and I thought that was really interesting.
Hmm. Is this something that the network works with people on?
They do. Michelle Norris and I had a discussion about this. Because she's been doing All Things Considered. She came over from TV in 2003. And so she had to go through some of the training to train specifically to host a radio program, and they do this at NPR. And what they encourage in the training at NPR is for hosts to sound like themselves. the kind of Susan Stamberg model, where she sounds just the same ordering a tuna fish sandwich as she does on the air interviewing somebody. And so that's what they coach people to be at National Public Radio.
Hmm. And has it always been that way? I suspect so.
I suspect so. I mean, Susan's story is really interesting that way because she took it upon herself when she first got on the air in 1972 on All Things Considered. She decided she was going to sound like what she'd grown up hearing, which was that kind of neutral male broadcasting, official broadcasting voice. And her boss said, no, you know, sound like yourself. And so she took back her own voice, which is, you know, she's got a New York City accent. She sounds Jewish, and she is Jewish. And that was controversial at the time, not that she sounded Jewish, but that she sounded like herself. And program directors from across the country would call NPR and say, what are you doing? This is the wrong choice, because she was so different. And they felt strange about it. And her boss defended her, kept her on the air, didn't tell her about any of this for years and years and years, and let her become herself, become distinctive, and to truly shape the sound of National Public Radio in its first decades.
Mm. Thinking about sounding like yourself, Tom and Ray, Public Radio's Grease Monkeys, the profile of the two of them, you didn't get to talk with them, but there is a profile of them, and you write about how the show works and that kind of thing. Very interesting. The opening to the profile of the Maliazzi brothers is, no one thought car talk would work, except Susan Stamberg.
Yes, yes. Susan, there are actually, I need to be fair, there are a few different stories floating out there about how car talk got started. A couple of other people, including Robert Siegel and Jay Kernis, the NPR vice president of programming I mentioned earlier, take some credit for hearing the show in its early years in Boston and taking an interest in it. But basically, the story that I got from Susan is that, you know, she heard a tape of their show out of WBUR in Boston, really loved it, wanted to have them on the air on her program, Weekend Edition Sunday at the time, back in 1987. But she couldn't get anyone else to like it, not NPR's news director, not her own producer, not even her husband, who was really into cars. And even the brothers themselves apparently were a little wary of getting a spot on her show because they'd have to interact with her instead of just interacting with each other. But then things started to move forward when they found out that Susan drove a 1974 Dodge Dart. And Tom Maliazzi really likes Dodge Darts. And so they decided to move forward and get a spot on her show in 1987. And very quickly, they were a hit and developed their own hour program that we know now as Car Talk.
Yeah. So you did interact with Doug Berman, though, right?
Yeah, he's their producer, and Doug and I corresponded, and I was able to get some insight into how the show was put together. A few things that a lot of people don't realize is it's actually taped in advance. It's not live. The calls are not, you know, chosen on Saturday mornings, which is when many stations air the program. So it's taped on Wednesdays, and the callers are picked in advance in that they leave a message saying, you know, what their car problems are, and then they're invited to be on the show. However, the brothers don't actually know, you know, what questions or concerns are coming up before they get them. So that spontaneous feeling of the show is maintained that way. But there is quite a bit of editing after the show is taped.
Okay.
So a lot of callers who may and say, you know, gradually say their car problem are edited down to the appropriate time. And you know, so you get that nice pace that the program has that way. But that's a surprise to a lot of people that it's not live.
Yeah, it has that feel to it, but it's not live. The callers who are set up then, that's an unfortunate way to put it, Celeste, but the callers then who get called back, do Tom and Ray, do they know when they tape the show on Wednesday afternoon, do they know what Mary in Sioux Falls wants to talk about?
What Doug told me was that they don't know anything about the calls. They just, you know, they just get them and they answer them. They're not prepared in advance of the taping.
Well, they're really good.
They are really good, and they really do know cars. It's amazing. Ray runs a garage called the Good News Garage in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he still has his role in that business, which actually started out as this kind of do-it-yourself garage where customers would come in and sort of be coached through a car repair. But that idea didn't work, so you know they decided to make it just a real garage where real mechanics would come and not just help people but actually do the work.
Hmm. Lisa Phillips is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions about the people behind the voices, public radio behind the voices. That's the title of the book that Lisa Phillips has written, Profiles of Public Radio's Most Treasured Personalities. Give us a call with your question or comment. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL. Anywhere else outside the Champaign-Urbana area, 800-222-WILL. You know someone else who is very good, spontaneous, with spontaneity, is Michael Feldman.
Yeah.
Host of What Do You Know? No rehearsal.
No rehearsal. It's a live stage show, and that's what you hear on the air.
So how does he prepare for the show? He does have, you know, his all the news that isn't. That has to be worked up ahead of time. But as far as how he interacts with callers and the people in the audience, that's all just spontaneous.
It is. It's pretty incredible because I'm sure you know, Celeste, from working in public radio, maybe I shouldn't use this word, but how ponderous a production staffs can be. You know, you've got your production meeting, then your another production meeting, and you plan everything in advance, and you figure out how you're going to do it. Well, they don't have production meetings at What Do You Know. They just basically do it with a very minimal script. So he does prepare his monologue of all the news that isn't. But very little else is pre-rehearsed. In fact, Jim Packard, who does the announcements during the show, he gets the script literally minutes before he's to go on the air. And it's just, you know, really just a few things that he's required to say to move the show along. But they don't meet and they don't do much prep as far as a team goes. But there is the necessary research on the places that he goes and things like that does happen. And the quiz questions need to be prepared in advance.
Right.
Feldman basically, you know, his deal is spontaneity. He's going out into the crowd, teasing people, coming up with his funny quips. And that's how he feels most present to his audience. He calls it, you know, 2 hours every week where he's truly present. He's not worrying and he's not anxious. He's just doing his thing.
Yeah, but that... His job is a lot more than 2 hours of work a week.
Oh, sure, yeah, you know? Yeah. He spends quite a bit of time in the office. You know, he preps as far as the research goes, as far as the quiz questions, but it's not a rehearsed show. It's a very spontaneous show.
Hmm. Again, listeners, you can join us this afternoon. We have about a minute left here in this portion of the program. I guess we're running down on time, darn. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Lisa Phillips, our guest this afternoon. She's the author of Public Radio Behind the Voices. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, let's go back now and talk about news and information. You're now teaching journalism. What are the ambitions of your students?
Oh, that's a great question. A lot of them don't know much about radio, and I started teaching radio this year as opposed to just print journalism, and I was able to get them excited about that. But generally, a lot of them are interested in public relations, but a number of them are interested in going into print journalism in all its forms, including web and so forth. And maybe with some effort, there'll be some encouragement to get back into radio, too.
Okay. Well, now the phone lines are lighting up like mad. Let's talk with a listener on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I really enjoy Fresh Air with Terry Gross.
Uh-huh.
And I'm disappointed that we don't get it in the local area anymore. I understand there was something about budgetary concerns with the show. But I recently bought Fresh Air Laughs, the CDs with Terry, the Fresh Air Laughs with Terry Gross, and 21 Stars of Comedy, and it's wonderful listening in the car. But I just know when I travel in the Midwest, often I do, I'm able to catch her show, and I really enjoy it, and I'm hopeful that we can have her back.
Yeah,
I
think that is our deep hope. We would love to have Fresh Air back on the air.
Okay.
But it is a matter of the do-re-mi. Let's talk with another listener this afternoon. Line 3, Urbana, hi.
Good afternoon. For the author being interviewed, this is a question I've been dying to ask somebody for some time. What have you heard, good, bad, or indifferent, about Celeste Quinn and David Inge and the way they do the interviews down here in East Central Illinois?
Wow. Well, I'm not from East Central.
I know.
I've heard many good things about the station. I live in upstate New York, but I don't hear anything in particular about these hosts, so I'm enjoying being with them today.
Just wondered how far word got around about, I think the job they do is fabulous, but...
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for that. What a nice call to end
That's
on.
That's very nice.
Thank you so much. And Lisa, thank you for joining us this afternoon. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Lots of great, wonderful stories in this book, Public Radio Behind the Voices. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Lisa Phillips has been our guest this afternoon. She is a journalist. Again, she's the author of Public Radio Behind the Voices. The book is published by CDS Books.